What I'd like to do is to commence this afternoon with a quote. Probably this quote from Henry Nouwen's book, Compassion, is one that has taken on great significance for me, and I think it's one that we'll probably come back to. Perhaps we'll use it to conclude today, and then we'll come back to it tomorrow. I've put it up on the overhead projector, and there's also a copy for you to take with you. But not too clear, so let me read it. What really counts is that in moments of pain and suffering, someone stays with us. More important than any particular action or word of advice is the simple presence of someone who cares. When someone says to us in the midst of a crisis, "I do not know what to say or what to do, but I want you to realise that I am with you, that I will not leave you alone," we have a friend through whom we can find consolation and comfort. In a time so filled with methods and techniques designed to change people, to influence their behaviour, and to make them do new things and to think new thoughts, we have lost the simple but difficult gift of being present to each other. We have lost this gift because we have been led to believe that presence must be useful. We say, "Why should I visit this person? I can't do anything anyway. I don't even have anything to say. Of what use can I be?" Meanwhile, we have forgotten that it is often in useless, unpretentious, humble presence to each other that we feel consolation and comfort. Simply being with someone is difficult because it asks of us that we share in the other's vulnerability, enter with him or her into the experience of weakness and powerlessness, become part of uncertainty, and give up control and self-determination. And still, whenever this happens, new strength and new hope is being born. Perhaps if there are any words that I'd like to underline in that quote, it would be the words that suggests that what really matters is that someone stays with us. Someone stays with us. A little while ago there was on the Encounter program, the ABC program on a Sunday morning, an interview with a Scotsman who is working in hospice care. And he told the story of a woman in his care, a woman who was dying, and she likened waiting for her death to waiting for a train. She referred to it as a slow train, but with a sure destination. And her words to the carer were these: "While I am waiting for the train to come, will you buy a platform ticket?" Now, those of us who are old enough to know what platform tickets are about, it means that you have access to the station, but not to the train, but you wait with those who are about to depart. So really it was a request to stay with me. And I think that that really does make some demands of us, because as the quote suggests, we feel that we must have words. We must somehow be useful. And sometimes it's difficult to stay when in fact we don't feel very useful at all, or we don't have the words. But the importance of staying. I think that for me, I have learned more about loss and grief by being with people, by listening, by documenting, by reflecting, than by reading the books and attending the seminars. I think books and seminars can be a catalyst to our learning, but what really matters is how we experience life from day to day, how we experience people, how we learn to be there for people and to share as fellow travellers the life experience of others. I think it's also important how we grow through our own experience of loss and grief, and we will come back to that in just a little while. But certainly what we do with our own losses and our own grieving will profoundly affect the effectiveness of our work or our involvement with other people. It will allow us more effectively to be there as a fellow traveller, one who is prepared to share the way with them. Because the subject is loss and grief and not death and dying, we want to try to look fairly broadly at this whole business of losing and grieving and not just limit it to loss and grief through death. It seems to me that there's a very real sense in which life is about losing and grieving. Now, thankfully, that's not the whole story by any means, but it is fundamental to human experience, loss and grief. One of the writers on the subject said this: grief is a natural part of human experience. We face minor grief almost daily in some situation or another. Now, there are three things that I'd like to affirm about loss and grief from the outset, and they are these. The first thing is that loss and grief is more normal than abnormal to our life experience. So it ought not to be resented as some sort of unwelcome intrusion to our lives. It is a normal part of life as we know it. The second thing is that we ought not to regard such experience as negative and bad, but rather we ought to see in loss and grief and the sorts of experiences that bring us to that some of the most significant opportunities for growth, for personal enrichment. And the reality is that such times can have and have had a destructive and negative influence on people's lives, but it need not be like that. The third thing that I'd like to affirm is that each experience is unique. There are no stereotypes. Even though the experience may be similar, the way you move through and the way somebody else moves through that experience will be unique to you, to the other person. So we need to be awfully careful about stereotyping. As we move through the various ages and stages of life, it is not uncommon in making that passage from one stage to another to experience a sense of loss and of grief. Those of you who are mothers might think about your child when you first tried to wean the child. There can be quite a profound sense of loss for the child. Think about when a child first leaves the security and warmth of home and maternal care to go to kindergarten and school. If you really think about it, and we'll make reference later to the familiar model of Kubler-Ross with her grief, her stages of grief, it's not uncommon for a child going to school for the first time to experience most, if not all, of those stages. And she talks about anger, depression, bargaining, it can all be there, and then the acceptance and so on. Getting married, not uncommon for people on the eve of becoming married to experience all sorts of emotional turmoil, profound turmoil, and often that can be associated with loss and grief. May be associated with fear of the unknown, of what is ahead, but I know I have talked to people who, you know, all the excitement and that of leading up to marriage, and all at once there is this incredible tailspin, emotional turmoil invades, and darkness and fear and uncertainty. Certainly if you become parents, you may grieve the loss of nights of sleep and being able to do just whatever you were used to doing. It can profoundly affect your way of living. My role in life has largely to do with aged care, and the ageing process is one that often finds people experiencing quite profound loss and grief. it needs to be said that when we talk about, you know, moving out of one stage into another, that often there is great gain. I mean, we talked about parenting. You mightn't care how many broken nights you have. It's just so wonderful to have this child. So the gain far outweighs any sense of loss. And if there are those sorts of gains as we move on through the various stages of life, then there may almost be no sense of loss at all. No need to grieve. But certainly what we want to say is that it is common to man, it is fundamental to human experience that we move through, often with some frequency, what it means to lose and to grieve. We suggested before that we ought not to regard such experiences as negative and bad. I think we tend to do that. We want to sort of push them away. How would you suggest that experiences of loss and the associated grief might be beneficial? How might they be good for us? Any thoughts? Okay, so certainly can enrich us in the sense of understanding of others. Thank you. Any other thoughts? Okay. Would that have to do with a sense of our own inadequacy and need to rely upon God, or? Right. Okay. Good. Okay. Sure. Yep. Okay, so you assess all of those sorts of things. Sorry? Right. Strengthening of character. Good. Values is another one. What really matters? I have a vivid memory of years ago working in a church, and it was just after the days when there was that great uprising in the Congo, and missionaries had experienced tremendous suffering, some of them, and I'll never forget being in church when Elaine de Russet came home, a WEC missionary, and held us spellbound for about an hour and a half as she told the story of what had happened to them, and how these two single women missionaries who had prayed for and longed for all this equipment for so long. I mean, there were typewriters and tape recorders and all this stuff that had been so important to their work. And they became aware that as these rebels moved through the jungles toward the compound, that if they found any of this Western gear, then it sort of incensed them, and the missionaries were at greater risk. So they took all this marvellous stuff out and buried it in the jungle before the rebels came. And she just kept saying, as she spoke to us, things don't matter anymore. Things don't matter anymore. And this clarification of values and loss and grief can certainly bring a far greater awareness of that to us. All right. So I guess that we're together because, to some extent at least, we are involved with other people. And we are concerned to know how to more adequately respond to people who are in loss and grief. And I think as an extension of that, it's important to say that we need at those times to know how to care for ourselves as well. It's not uncommon for people who become really involved in the darkness of others, in the grief, the bereavement of other people, to kind of lose their way, to lose their own sense of perspective, to invest so much of their own emotions, of their own self, in the helping of others, that you sort of lose your way. So how can you avoid that? I think if we're going to work meaningfully with other people in these areas, we need to have established some kind of relational base for ourselves, So we need to be able to retreat and to say to significant other people, look, this is what is happening for me. This is what I'm involved in at the moment, and this is what I've said, and just be open to the feedback of other people. Now, I think we are at great risk if we are solo flyers and just sort of go in alone and have no sense of accountability to significant others in what we are doing. We need to be able to come back and process and assess the effectiveness and be open to constructive criticism in the work that we are doing. And I think we must take responsibility for ourselves to put that in place. Now, if we wait for somebody to do that for us, we may wait forever. But to build a strong relational base, if we're going to be involved in people with people in these areas of ministry. Maybe all of us have known people in life, you know, whose life journey is just so sad. There is just so much of loss and grief, and you try to make sense of it, and you really don't know how to begin to make sense of it. It's just sort of one thing on top of another. Whereas others seem to move through life with much less trouble. One of the warnings that I'd like to sound today has to do with working with other Christians. And I mean, I imagine that most of us are Christian, though I wouldn't presume that we all are. That Scotsman that I was talking about before in his interview, the fellow working in the hospice care, made the comment, which in a sense didn't surprise me, having worked now for a couple of years, especially in aged care, but he made the comment that sometimes Christians die less well than those who have never professed faith in Christ. Now, we might like to ask why that is. Part of it, I think, and only part of it, has to do with the kind of unrealistic expectations we live with, we impose upon ourselves. So that, for example, you may be working with a Christian person at a time of loss and grief, and you may hear that person saying things like, I shouldn't be thinking this way, I'm a Christian. I shouldn't be feeling like this. I shouldn't be behaving like this. And the difficulty is sort of that they get caught between all these shouldn'ts and expectations and the reality of what is. Whether I think I should or I shouldn't, this is in fact what is going on. Thank you. Can it wait? All right, I think it will. So, what we are trying to respond to is the reality of what is, of where the person is. And I think if we are going to follow Jesus in terms of the way he came to us and his ministry, that the incarnational approach to ministry is the only valid model that we have, where we are prepared to enter in a sense, to be born in to the situation and confront it as it is. This is the reality. And to stay with that and to allow the grace of God to work in that, you know, to enter the darkness. A little while ago, I was talking with a couple, husband and wife, who had separated, and the husband had stayed in North Queensland, the wife had returned to Brisbane, and she really had no thoughts of re-establishing the relationship at all. It had just been too abusive, too costly, and he was sort of doing his own thing up there, and then he decided that he wanted to try again, and so he came south and we began to talk, the three of us. And at one stage I became really aware in him of unresolved grief. And I tell this story because I think many, many people carry within them grief that is quite unresolved, that has never been addressed adequately. And so I said to this man, I think you need to cry. And he said, I haven't cried for 28 years. And I said to him, what happened 28 years ago? And he said, my mother died. And he had never grieved the death of his mother. And sometimes the reason why we have difficulty grieving is because we sort of feel this is punishment. I deserve this. This is happening because I've been bad. And children can be especially prone to that sort of thinking. So if I've been bad and this is punishment, why should I grieve what is happening? So, back to the story. It was like giving him permission to do something that he'd not done in 28 years. And he said, I am afraid to cry, that if I start, I will not be able to stop. And he did start to cry. And he just simply left the room, ran out. And he'd been gone for quite a while, and I was beginning to get a bit anxious. So I went and found him, and he was still weeping. And his words were, these are the tears of 28 years. Well, you know, working in aged care is to become aware of how long people can carry unresolved grief. Let me tell you a story. This is a very up-to-date story, and I think it helps to illustrate what I'm trying to say. Just last week, in one of the homes that I work in, I was asked to visit a lady who was depressed. Now, usually this particular lady is very bright, and she's just a lovely presence in the home. She befriends other people and seems to be very well adjusted to her circumstances and environment. She's certainly well liked by other residents and by the staff, but she was depressed. When we talked, the presenting incident was that there had been a kind of interaction between her and a senior staff member that had left her feeling put down, that another resident had been preferred above her in a particular situation. And so I visited her in a room, and she was so depressed that they really couldn't entice her from her room, and so she was being given her meals there and so on. So we began to talk, and little by little one thing led to another, and she told me of a time when she was living in England prior to coming to Australia, and she grew up in a happy, sort of well-adjusted family. She married, and life went very well for her until her husband was diagnosed as having a terminal cancer and died at the age of 38. 8 years after that, her daughter died at 21. Not long after that, two of her three sons, and she'd had three sons and the one daughter, two of her three sons moved to Australia. So she was left in England with her extended family of origin and many friends and the church that she was involved with, and this one son. The son had been in love with a young woman who had rejected him for somebody else, and so the son said, if I can't have her, I won't have anybody. And so he chose to remain single and stayed with mum. When he was 38, he was diagnosed as having the same cancer as killed his dad, and could not cope with facing the death. He saw his father died and suicided. So her Australian family, the two sons, said, mum, why don't you come out and start life again? And so she did. Now, she left all this support, the family of origin, the church, and she came to Sydney, where one of the sons was living, and settled there, and was very happy. She made new friends, and just sort of typical of her outgoing personality. And then she began to feel the weight of years and said, look, I don't want to be a burden to you. I think I need to go into a retirement village. So this son in Sydney said, well, why don't you go north? I mean, you have friends in one of the homes up there, and the other son lives on the Gold Coast. So up she came to Brisbane and settled in this home, only to find that the friends who were already in the home really had established a life of their own and were often not even there. And her son lived on the Gold Coast, and so didn't often come. And so the story unfolded, and we looked at photo albums and so on. And I said to her after she'd finished telling the story, you know, as I listened to the story as you told it, you kind of talked about the death of your husband and the death of your daughter. And when you came to talk about the death of your son by suicide, there were just these great sobs that came from somewhere way down there. I mean, it was all there. And immediately she sort of put the stopper on and kept it in. And I said, what was that about? And I mean, it was more than I suppose could be told in just a few moments, but it was largely about those who tried to comfort her or tried to be with her at that time. I mean, she had people beside her saying, Christian people beside her saying, well, of course, your son is a murderer. He has killed himself. He cannot possibly find acceptance with God. And this woman has carried this grief. I mean, she hasn't known how to grieve for that boy because she was unsure anyhow whether he was with God or where he was. And that's the sort of stuff that people can carry for many, many, many years. And all at once, you know, while mostly it's under control, it can break out in behaviour that seems to be uncharacteristic and alienating. And, you know, just another illustration that we've become aware of in working with the aged, and I think that this illustrates something that is sort of far broader. You know, people come into aged care and their relatives, who are sort of probably glad in many instances to have placed them in care, are saying, well, look, aren't you lucky? You know, you're in this lovely home and all these caring people, and they're not feeling lucky at all. I mean, what they've had to do is to sort through a lifetime of mementos and belongings and all the rest of it, and take with them a port, you know, just one port or a box of precious things, and all the rest is left behind. And they are in grief very often. And yet the well-meaning friends and relatives are saying, aren't you lucky to be in such a nice place? So, you know, what really is going on for people? There's a little book written by a Granger Westberg. I saw it advertised in the latest Coorong booklet, so it's currently available, and it's just a short book called Good Grief. It's worth reading. He begins the book by saying this: we spend a good portion of our lives working diligently to acquire those things that make life rich and meaningful. Friends, a wife or husband, children, a home, a job, material comforts, money and security. What happens to us when we lose any of these persons or things which are so important to us? Quite naturally, we grieve over the loss of anything important. Sometimes if the loss is great, the very foundations of our lives are shaken. We are thrown into deep despair. He points out that people will grieve most for what they value most. Just good to catch up with Jean for a moment before this session started. We were together in Mount Isa for some years, and as I was thinking about what this fellow was saying, my mind went back to the days up there when Cyclone Tracy devastated Darwin. And we were living in Mount Isa at that time, and the refugees began to filter through, sort of moving south away from the devastation. And one of the stories that really left a lasting impression with me was that many of the European people who had gone to Darwin to make the big dollars and to acquire all the possessions were saying, our lives are ruined. You know, it's all over. And I mean, they were in shock and grief, and it was all over. And the Aborigines got up and built another humpy, and it didn't faze them at all. was just a cyclone. So their sense of loss was nowhere near as profound because their values were completely different. So we will grieve most for that which we value most. And as we said earlier, one of the ways in which grief and loss can serve us has to do with the clarification of values. Now, just a few weeks ago, I attended a conference for the Association of Health and Welfare, I think it's called. Excellent keynote speaker, Canon Norman Orton from England. And I bought a tape of one particular address he gave, and this is what he said, and I quote, "I think one of the most important aspects of our pastoral care and of our spirituality is that we come to terms with the meaning of our own dying. For not until we ourselves have worked out the purpose of life and the meaning of death can we hope to be of assistance to those who find themselves in the valley of the shadow of death. For at each deathbed, we come face to face with our own death." Now, I think what he is saying there is also relevant to what we are talking about today, the broader dimensions of loss and grief. You know, how realistically have we faced up to our own losses? How adequately have we learned to grieve for those losses? What is happening for us in that regard? And we're suggesting that it's only as we are adequately processing our own issues and growing as people in these ways that we can hope to be of any real help to others. What I'd like you to do is to work through a little exercise, and there seems to be an urgent phone call that I need to make. So while you're doing the exercise, I'll just sort of disappear and attend to that. But let me explain the exercise. I've called it Little Losses and Profound Losses. And on the sheet, there's a number of questions. The first one is this. As I look back over my life, I regard the following as among the little losses. Okay? So for you, the fact that the family pet died last year may have been of no consequence. You simply picked up the dog and buried it in the backyard. I spoke to somebody quite recently who told me how the family grieved the death of the dog for 6 months. They grieved the loss of the pet. So it's to do with values. But I regard among the little losses as the loss of hair. My most profound losses have been, so just to identify what the most profound losses have been, I have grieved over these losses in the following ways. How did you grieve? What did you do? The fourth question is, if there is any unresolved grief for me, it would be in regard to. Okay, just allow yourself to become aware. I know when my father died, it was a kind of matter-of-fact response at first. And it wasn't until about 5 years down the track that I realised how much I missed him. And the floodgates burst open. If there is any unresolved grief, it would be in regard to what? The loss I most fear is. Okay, so that's the worksheet, and I think that we will take... how's our time going? All right, we need to take about 10 minutes just to work through it. If we could just quickly pass these out. And do you guys feel the answer to this question? Don't ponder too much over time. Just answer as honestly as you can. Become aware of what is there for you as you read the question. And then after 10 minutes, just in case, I should be back, well, I'm pretty well in, but just in case I'm not, we're going to break into groups of five and just quickly share with each other, as we're able to, what we've written down. Would you mind just watching that? 10 minutes to answer, and then 5 minutes for sharing. Of five, yes. Thanks. You feel that you would like to go back to somebody in the group and, you know, perhaps just to offer some words, and it may only be, you know, I really felt with you as you told your story. Alright, because we're not, sorry. Are you going to be here tomorrow? Okay. We do have an overhead transparency, which I think will address that question, if that's okay. You know, I think often you get some kind of intuitive awareness that there is more there than is being talked about or is being presented in the dialogue, and that there is great value in testing that. I mean, just offering it, you know, I have this sense that there's something behind the scenes that's going on for you. Can you talk about it? And if they say no, well, you just stay with that. But if there is that awareness that really there is something there, then usually... I remember being involved in a program some years ago and I said to the teacher, you know, if you have that kind of hunch, how reliable is it? And he said, 99% it's right. Now that may be an overstatement, but I think it's always worth checking out if you sense that there's something going on. And I think especially if we work prayerfully and trust the Holy Spirit to guide us and to give insights into how best to help people to healing, to stay with it. But certainly we'll come back to that tomorrow. Okay, we've indicated that we really want to talk about loss and grief fairly broadly, and I've just got three transparencies that we'll look through fairly quickly, which have to do with the types of loss that people can experience. Some of them are fairly obvious, but we'll have a look at them nevertheless. Okay, this really is a bit poor, it's not too visual. But I'll read them out to you just so you'll know what they're about. These have to do with physiological losses. Firstly, through surgery, where we're talking about amputation, mastectomy, colostomy, hysterectomy, facial disfigurement, and it could go on and on. But they are all significant. Loss of senses. We've only named sight, hearing and touch. But there are people who have also lost their sense of taste and of smell. So the loss of senses can be quite profound. Chronic illness. We're talking about asthma, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, arthritis, cardiac, stroke. Some of the stroke victims have experienced profound loss, haven't they? Because, that can afflict people in midlife, in the midst of being very active and the enjoyment of life, and all of a sudden this terrible, debilitating condition, the paralysis. And we've got one fairly young man in one of our homes, and his anger is so intense, this incredible injustice that has been put upon him. From being a very active man, you know, really doing it all, now needing to be showered and toileted and everything. Just on those sorts of issues, the loss of bladder and bowel control in people who are ageing, and that really is so profound, isn't it? And, and I just sort of think of another fellow that we knew fairly well who has now died, but he had lost control both of bladder and bowel, and he simply tried to starve himself so that this would be less a problem. Such was the humiliation of needing to be cared for in that way. Birth-related losses, miscarriage, abortion, stillbirth, infertility. People, in relation to abortion, I think, are often in need of tremendous help and sympathy, because often decisions to have a child aborted are made under great stress, and years down the track, issues from the past have a way of catching up, and the sort of judgmental attitude that is sometimes heard is just so destructive. You need tremendous compassion. And then we're talking about losses that have to do with the destruction of self. So there are the various addictions, attempted suicide, and then when suicide is successful. It's interesting, we're going to be looking at psychological and also circumstantial or environmental losses, and they can all be so interrelated. We talk about physiological losses, but the way that impacts upon one's psychological well-being, it's all kind of woven together, isn't it? But there's some of the losses that can happen for people in terms of their bodies, their physiological being. Yes. And not just for the child.
No,
yes, absolutely. Yes, very much so. All right. Just a few of the... it's a bit sad, isn't it? We're calling these psychological losses. I'll need to read them out to you. Process of ageing, loss of youth, loss of midlife, dignity and self-respect, femininity. I remember in one of the churches where I worked, a lady who had a mastectomy, and there's a profound physical loss to start with. She came home to her husband, who had never kind of responded well to the relationship, and he simply said to her, "Well, now you are half a woman." So the loss of femininity, the loss of status, the loss of life expectations, the loss of sexual drive, sexual attractiveness, the loss of bodily functions. We talked about that under physiological, but here it is under psychological as well. Victims of rape and incest, what are the losses there? Loss of personal security, of the capacity to cope. Okay. I don't have these on handout, but they are certainly available if you'd like to complete any lists that you're making. They can be available afterwards. Okay, we're calling this environmental or circumstantial loss. One of the most significant that we are aware of and often find ourselves working with today has to do with marriage and family life. I have an article which was released through a bulletin magazine some years ago, and it has to do with separation and divorce. The title of the article is "Why Men Hurt the Most." Now, I'm not sure that we would all agree with all that the article is saying, but it is certainly saying that it was at a time when there were these incredible acts of aggression on the part of men who had felt victimised by family law courts, and so attacks on judges, and just this great anger, which was obviously an expression of great pain. But that is just so profound, isn't it? So widespread. And we read about grandparents who are now bereft of grandchildren because of separation and divorce, and the loss can be so great. The loss of home by fire, flood or bankruptcy. The loss of job. The issue of retirement can be a fairly significant one. I remember reading, I think it was in a magazine, and some of you may have read it, about a man who retired and never told his wife. Every morning she made his lunch and he packed his briefcase and got on the train and went to town and walked around all day and came back on the train that he'd always caught home, and could not face this loss. So he played a game for a long time. Loss of income, loss of pets, loss of career opportunities, loss of homeland, possessions, educational opportunity, loss of lifestyle by injury, loss of culture, of relational opportunities, loss of security and peace of mind through burglary. Okay, do we want to talk about any of those or any of the losses on the other two sheets? Certainly is expansive, isn't it? I mean, the kinds of losses that people can experience in life. And what of these would we regard as little losses, and what would be profound losses? The thing is, what may be little for some will be quite profound for others. So we can never sort of judge what is happening for another out of our own life experience. We need to listen for what they are saying. You know, as any of us who have done any counselling training will be aware of, just the inane sort of expression that says, "I know what you're going through," and you feel like blowing a raspberry. People may have some idea, but you need to listen rather than presume that you know what is happening for the other. It's just so easy to interpret out of our own experience and miss the point altogether. All right. I have four models of the kind of grief process, the reaction to loss. I included Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, although most of you, I imagine, will be fairly familiar with what she is saying. But there are a couple of others as well, and I think you'll find that they all somehow parallel. Some just sort of say a little bit more than others. But let's have a quick look at them. So, in Death and Dying, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross particularly speaks about the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stages, and then beyond that there is the reaching out. So first of all, there's often the denial, this isn't happening to me. There's the anger, which is why me. The bargaining, help me and I'll go to church, I'll be better. I'll use my money for your work, God, if I can just recover from this. Depression, which is sort of very inward looking, poor me. And then there's the beginnings of kind of emergence, acceptance, which suggests it is me, but it's okay. And then the reaching out, I can make use of this. I can reach out to others. Okay? The next model is from Westberg's book, where he talks about good grief, grief that is good. Now, I think being in the state of shock is similar to the denial and isolation. the emotion, whatever that might be, but certainly coming to a sort of an emotional outburst where what may have been repressed during denial suddenly surfaces, and often with a vengeance. We feel depressed and very lonely. We may experience physical symptoms of distress. We may become panicky. We feel a sense of guilt about the loss. We are filled with hostility and resentment. We are unable to return to normal activities. If we're familiar with some of the work of Bill Wilkie on understanding stress breakdown, around about 7 and 8 there's a great similarity which suggests that the grief experience can have quite a degree of stress and distress in it. Gradually hope comes through, and number 10, we struggle to readjust to reality. Okay, yes. The last couple. Would it help if you have the... I think it's more complex than that. It's not that it's sort of sequential in that one will lead to another. I think it's that you can experience all that in one day or in one morning, and it may all be mixed up.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. But going over this day, having counseled for 3 days, so even though the week is still going on 3 days, counseled for different clients, they haven't been on the pressure.
I think that's true. Would you?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. Yes. I'm sure you're right. Now, I have to say, I'm not sure who's responsible for these. I just have a file of stuff on loss and grief, and this is from sheets that have been gathered, and there was no indication as to whose work this is. But this really has to do with sort of the time element, sort of the old suggestion that wounds are healed through the process of time. I think that's an inadequate statement. I'm not sure that anything happens quite as automatically. I think certainly time changes and affects the way we experience things, but it's not sort of that it happens automatically. On this model, there's again the shock and denial, the emotional eruption, the anger, illness. We talked about physical manifestations. Panic again, guilt, depression and loneliness, re-entering of difficulties, so a kind of stage where you're able to face up to life and to reality again. And then the sense of hope, the sense of affirming reality, which is another important insight in this model, affirming reality, and then moving on to new strength and healing. Okay. And the fourth one, again denial, which this model suggests is a response to provide you with time. So while we sometimes think that sort of to be in the stage of denial is a bit counterproductive, it may not be at all. It may just simply be biding time. Questioning, the why me, what went wrong, how did this happen? The questions are endless because there are no real answers. so the why, the big why. Sort of moving between hope and bargaining, the blaming attitude. It's interesting, the lady who was telling me about grieving the family pet for 6 months, it was the dog that had been run over, and somebody had left the gate open, and she was aware of that, and she simply closed the gate and never let anybody else know that it had been left open. The dog had a bit of a reputation for burrowing under the fence or the gate anyhow. She let them think that that's what had happened, because the inevitable happened. Whose fault was it? Who did it? Who can we blame for this? So the wise mother intervened, and they just tried to face it as a family. Talking about depression and guilt, and then sort of the emotion, unexpected reaction, withdrawal and acceptance. The recognition that this loss is a part of your life. The hard reality. It will never be the same. This is a new stage of the way. Okay, we've just got a few minutes left today. What I'd like to do is just to draw us back to a couple of passages in the Bible that I think have great relevance to what we're trying to say. Do you want that lift up for a bit longer? Down a bit? Is that okay? Healed new strength. We'll just use one because I think you've all had a fairly full day, and I'll refer to one or two others which I think can be really helpful. Probably the Psalms have been used extensively in offering comfort to people in times of loss and grief because of the way they speak of human experience in such a broad way. And the one that I'd like to offer to you to think about is the 42nd Psalm, which is probably one of the better known of the Psalms. And it's where David begins by saying, "As the deer longs for the water brooks, so longs my soul for you, O God. My soul is athirst for God, athirst for the living God. When shall I come to appear before the presence of God? My tears have been my food day and night, while all day long they say to me, 'Where now is your God?' I pour out my soul when I think on these things, how I went with the multitude and led them into the house of God with the voice of praise and thanksgiving among those who keep holy day. Why are you so full of heaviness, O my soul, and why are you so disquieted within me? Put your trust in God, for I will yet give thanks to him, who is the help of my countenance and my God." And then he goes on to say, "My soul is heavy within me." If we read a psalm like that in the light of loss and grief, what's happening for David? He's a displaced man. He's in exile. He remembers back to the days when he led the multitude to the house of God with thanksgiving. So, you know, we're talking about loss through change of circumstance, environment, being removed from the familiar, from the meaningful. And he owns that there is this heaviness within him, a restlessness, a sense of disquiet, a sort of distractedness. He acknowledges that his tears have been his food day and night, and that there are even those who do not understand, the Job's comforters, who are saying, you know, where's God now? Where is God? in the midst of this. And that seemed to be very much related to the tears. The tears. Remember reading a story, and some of you may have also read the story, and I certainly met and had some talks at length with the man who wrote the story of his wife's death through cancer. And he and his family had journeyed with her through the difficult days from when it was first diagnosed, and they knew that her death was imminent and they were ready for it. And the hardest part of all was when a group of three ladies came knocking on their door saying, "We've come to pray for your wife's healing." Now, they had become reconciled within their hearts and minds that God was sovereign in this and that he had led them thus far. And great peace as a family in sharing that journey. And then all at once, this group saying, "We've come to pray for healing." The difficulty for him was, should I let them in or not? By not allowing them in, am I sinning against God? By allowing them in, am I disrupting this journey which has sort of become so sure, so certain for us? Well, I guess only God really has the answers to situations like that, and all he could do was to act according to his own conviction and to seek to walk with integrity before God and his family. But it was very difficult. You all want to know if he let them in. No, he didn't. And it was a triumphant death. I mean, we're so scared of death, aren't we, often? I heard this fellow, this Scotsman, say that it is part of God's creative plan that we should die. And we need not be afraid. Can I offer to you again the words of Noun, and I'd like you to take this sheet with you today and to think about it, and we will come back to it tomorrow. What really counts is that in moments of pain and suffering, someone stays with us. More important than any particular action or word of advice is the simple presence of someone who cares. When someone says to us in the midst of a crisis, "I do not know what to say or what to do, but I want you to realise that I am with you, that I will not leave you alone. We have a friend through whom we can find consolation and comfort. In a time so filled with methods and techniques designed to change people, to influence their behaviour, to make them do new things and think new thoughts, we have lost the simple but difficult gift of being present to each other. We have lost this gift because we have been led to believe that presence must be useful. We say, 'Why should I visit this person? I can't do anything anyway. I don't even have anything to say. Of what use can I be?' Meanwhile, we have forgotten that it is often in useless, unpretentious, humble presence to each other that we feel consolation and comfort. Simply being with someone is difficult because it asks of us that we share in the other's vulnerability, enter with him or her into the experience of weakness and powerlessness, become part of uncertainty, and give up control and self-determination. And still, whenever this happens, new strength and new hope is being born." Reminds me of the story of a lady who, and it was a story that goes back to the last war, had received word, a young woman actually, that her husband had been killed in action. And, you know, the well-meaning people had all the words, you know, how he'd done it for his country and how proud they were of him and blah, 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 blah. And another woman came and put her arms around her and cried and said nothing. And she said, "That was the source of comfort for me, that somebody felt with me to that extent."